This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/ifanboy.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Jason Aaron. Hey, this is Josh with iFanboy. This is another episode of Talksplode as unlocked by the iFanboy patrons. Well, thank you about that forever. There's nothing you can do about it. Today, I have Jason Aaron with me. I have never actually done a long-form interview with Jason Aaron. I have known him since the start of his career in comics, which was somewhere around the start of our video show and all that stuff. But I've never gotten a chance to really talk to him about comics, sit down for a long time. And he was kind enough to give me some of his time to do so. So I hope you enjoy it. I am here with, I'm gonna say it, with an old friend, with Jason Aaron.
It's been a long time.
It has, and it's that sort of amount of time where time was compressed, so you just look and you go, wow, it's been a decade. Oops. How did that
happen? Has it been a decade since I was on the show? I mean, it feels like.
I've never done an audio show with you. These are sort of the longer form talks. We've talked on video. We've talked in real life. But Christ, I saw you the last time in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah? Oh, so that has been a while.
14, 16? I mean, it was a while back.
I mean, granted, to me, everything feels like it was at least 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this literally was a long time ago.
What's interesting is that I was sort of looking at, you know, when you got started in comics and, you know, Other Side and Scalped weren't as far back as I thought. I think I thought that was early 2000 stuff, but, you know, was it 2006, 2007?
Yeah, 2006. didn't you interview me?
Oh, yeah.
Like, interview in quotes, like...
Connor?
2005, 2006, like
it
around...
It would have been six, maybe, yeah. Connor did, and we basically shoved Connor. You both in front of a camera, and neither of you knew what to do or what to talk about.
That's probably literally my first interview ever, right?
Yeah, I mean,
the great unseen, you know, will never be seen by anyone.
It was not. I can't remember if we actually cut it or not. I think we might have, just because it was like we've all done poorly here. and I think a big part of that was that we shoved Connor in to do it, and it might have been his first too. I don't know. These were the renegade days.
Well, we all recovered nicely from that.
Yeah, it's working out.
We eventually got our shit together. Somewhat.
You can say that. so t- take me, we were, before we got started, we were talking about sort of the first comics you read and, like where, when did comics sort of become part of your life? When did they get to you?
Well, I've got the very first comic I read. It's sitting on my desk right now. I pulled it out recently because, you know, I'm doing DC stuff now for the first time. The first thing I'm doing is a Batman book. The second thing I've got signed to do is some issues on Action Comics. So the first comic I ever read was issue of World's Finest, you know, with Superman and Batman on the cover. It's number 258. From 1979, so I would have been 6 years old when this came out.
Did you get it new, or was it? Because I feel like we always used to get boxes of old comics that would just show up in places.
Yeah, I think I did. I don't remember exactly how I got it.
Sure.
I've got two issues of World's Finest from around that period. It was not until, like, you know, 3-4 years later to where I was, like, buying comics constantly off the spinner rack. So it took a few years before I, you know, became like a rabid fan. But this is definitely like the first one I ever had. The cover has fallen off. Like, it's been read and reread so many times. And it was a great first issue in that it's one of those big fat dollar comic issues. So it's got Green Arrow story, Hawkman, Shazam.
Oh, wow.
You know, Superman, Batman, Black Lightning. So it was a great, like, entry point into, like, here's, you know, a whole universe of characters. So I had to put, like, a little shout out, a little nod to it in my at first Action Comics issue, just as, you know, like, what a wild way to kind of come full circle now, all these years later, where I'm writing Batman and Superman.
Did you, like, do you, like, when you're working on comics, like, do you think of the stuff that happened in that? Do you think that still influences you?
I mean, maybe not in this specific issue, but I mean, I definitely, they're, you know, kind of like hallmarks in my mind that I hearken back to a lot. I think, you know, I think probably with any writer, there's the things that are just like formative, whether it's not just this movie, but this beat in that movie,
right,
you know, or whatever. So I think with comics, yeah, there's a lot of those books for me. I mean, when I did kind of become a big fan and started going to the spinner rack regularly, it was pretty much all DC stuff. But New Teen Titans was one of the first books where I don't remember what issue number it was on at that point, but I definitely, that was the first book where I was like, oh, I got to go back and get all the ones that I had missed.
Oh.
And so I started trying to do that. I mean, that would take me a while because it'd be a few more years before I would set foot in like an actual comic book store. But Titans, you know, a book like Atari Force, which launched right around that same time. So it was a number one issue that I could pull off the rack. And Blue Devil was another one that started around then that I loved. And then of course, you know, like, Crisis came along, and I was already a big Wolfman Perez fan, so it was perfect timing for that. And then all those books that kind of came after that. So, you know, the Batman stuff, the John Byrne Superman, Perez Wonder Woman, like I was all over all of that.
Do you in your mind are sort of those versions of the characters the way that, like the way that you see those characters to this day? Because there's still a little bit of that with me.
For sure. I think, you know, and I mean, say what you want about John Byrne, but so much of his work was very formative for me. I think his Superman did imprint on me in some way. I mean, I think some of that is maybe not the best way. Like, there's some stuff I look back now at his Superman that I disagree with, but I think that still kind of set the benchmark for me in a big way at, you know, at that time. And I mean, with Superman, you also had the movies that were a big part of it. You know, I remember seeing that Superman 1 and 2. Well, I remember seeing Superman 4 in the theater, you know, I saw them all in the theater. And the, of course, the Super Friends and then the Superpowers, like I was all over that. So yeah, I think all that stuff mixed together to kind of, define those characters for me in some way forever. Just like the Teen you know, the Teen Titans. I love the Tom Taylor book that's coming out now. Mm-hmm. And I haven't always been able to enjoy the Teen Titans books over the years, because to me, they're just those versions of the characters mm-hmm. from that original series, or those original two series. And it's hard for me to see them as anything other than that, you know?
Well, I think that's one of Tom's sort of strengths, is that he probably similar generationally, like his way that he goes after a lot of these characters is sort of deepening the character of them. And a lot of that sort of stems from then. And so I've found that people around your age, my age, are like, it's very resonant. It's just sort of hitting it in just the right way. But I felt the same way.
Yeah, it's hard to do. I mean, it's hard. I think Tom's done a great job. I would also look at something like Gerard Way's run on Doom Patrol. And, you know, I'm such a huge fan of Grant Morrison's run on Doom Patrol, and always thought, like, how do you do that again? Right. Like, aren't those, I mean, how do you take what he did and build on it? And Gerard did a really great job of that, of sort of, we're clearly heavily influenced by that stuff, but also kind of taking it forward in a way that was exciting. So hats off to creators who are able to, you know, to do that with things that feel so very precious to so many of us.
But you've had to do that a lot. So when you approach something, I mean, I could go down the list of all the stuff. So if, you know, I'm trying to think of when the first, you know, like you're Punisher Max with Steve Dillon, for God's sakes, you know, when you're approaching something like that, and you were a younger writer at that point, you know, how did you think about approaching something like that, improving on, you know, carrying it forward?
You know, I mean, I think that was one of those kind of challenges I think you have to be excited about as a creator, right? Like, I was such a huge fan of what Garth Ennis had done on Punisher Max. Like, you know, that's still one of my favorite runs by anybody in all the time I've been reading comics, right? Like, that's the definitive Punisher run. Mm-hmm. So I was a huge fan of that as it was coming out. And as soon as I heard that Garth was leaving, you know, I knew I wanted to throw my hat in the ring to follow it, which on the one hand is crazy, right? Like, that's why would you ever want to do that? Cause you're following a legend. And I knew, I'm not Garth. I don't tell stories in the same way as Garth. I can't do what he has done. If I'm going to do something, it's going to have to be different. So on the one hand, it feels like, you know, like you don't want to follow a run like that. But on the other hand, I think you have to be excited to do that. And you know, that run was important to me. That character had become really important to me. And I felt like I had something I could say and something I could add to that. So I think those are the kind of challenges that have to get you excited. I don't think you can be kind of cowed and worried about living up to what's come before. I mean, I think if that's the way you are, you could say that about any, mm-hmm. any company owned character, you know, at Marvel or DC, right? Like, every one of them's got their definitive run somewhere along the way. So I think you always have to take everything you can from what's been done before and try to, you know, be excited to bring something of yourself to the mix. And then from there, who knows? Like, you know, sometimes you'll add something to it and, you know, some people dig it, some people don't. Other times you'll be, you know, looked at as like you've done something that'll be remembered forever. Like, you never know how people are going to respond. But to me, it's just about that excitement, that, you know, wanting to step up to bat after following a lineup full of legends, right?
Well, it's really interesting. So for a lot of people, you'll read, you know, a sort of a great run, and you know what you're reading, a great run, if you're sort of really into comics. And so like, during that time, you're reading it and you know, part of you is thinking, here's what I would do from here. Here's where I would go. And sort of having you were in the building. It's not like you were new at it, but, you know, to have the chutzpah to be like, I want to take it from here, and I'd like to keep Steve Dillon. Actually, no, because it was Gorin. Anyway, he did.
Right. Yeah. Steve hadn't done any of the Punisher.
He did the Marvel Knights Punisher.
Right.
That was it. That's what I was thinking. Yep. Of. But still, I mean, even so, I mean, there's a confidence to that. And you said you got excited about it. And I think that, like, what comes, do you, like, do you get excited about a thing and then approach it that way, or do you have to sort of psych yourself up for it, or does the story sort of hit you and then you sort of feel like you know what you're doing, or you're like, you jump out of a net? Like, how does it work for you?
Right. I think it's been, you know, any one of those at different times over the course of my career. Like, they're all kind of different. I kind of quickly figured out in my time breaking into comics that it was not wise just to like chase after characters. Mm-hmm. It was more important just like, you know, who are the editors? What are the real world relationships like, as opposed to the fictional ones? So I kind of focused on that part and then just sort of went with what felt right in the moment, what kind of came along, you know. I mean, there was, you can look at my career and see all the jobs I said yes to. There were plenty of them along the way that I said no to. And still, you know, great jobs, great characters that I would have loved to have write, but it didn't feel right in the moment. Timing wasn't right or whatever. Something just didn't click for me. So I've always just kind of gone, I've never had like a master plan of like, all right, well, I'm going to write, you know, Ghost Rider for this many years, and then I'll move up to the X-Men, and then I'll move on to the Avengers, and then I'll jump to DC. Like, I've never looked at it like here's my 10-year plan. It's just kind of going with what feels right as I go along. And I think, you know, I think every creator I know, when you break into comics, you always have that feeling of like, at some point they're going to realize I'm not supposed to be in this party, right? Like, I'm not invited to this party.
Do you know anyone who doesn't have imposter syndrome?
No, I don't. I mean, if they don't, I would wonder like, what's going on with this dude? You know, like, I don't trust him. Why? You know, maybe their work is terrible just because they don't have that feeling. Mm-hmm. The most successful people I know in comics all have that feeling. Like, mm-hmm. This is all going to evaporate at some point. You know, I'm going to get a call of like, you know, you were never supposed to do this. You can't do this anymore. So I think you always kind of have that, a little bit of that feeling. And I think for me at Marvel, it took me a while before I was able to sort of develop. I mean, I think you always have to write with confidence, even if you don't feel very confident.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, Brian Azzarello told me that when I was pitching Scalped, of, he, you know, when he was pitching 100 Bullets and Karen Berger asked him, like, so you can wrap this all up, and, you know, if you only get 20 issues, you can wrap this up, right? And he lied and was like, oh yeah, absolutely. So you kind of always, you go into it with the idea of like, I'm going to get as many issues as I need to tell this story, right? Even when the chances seem slim. Like, I did that with Scalped, you know, and it worked out. So it still took me a while at Marvel before, I think with Thor was the first time I felt like, okay, I've been here for a while, and I feel like if I just do a good job, I can be on this book until I'm done, you know? But I don't know. Maybe that's a meandering answer to your question.
No, it's great. Like, I'm actually, like you said, Thor, I'm sort of looking at the sort of runs that came before it. If there was that the, I mean, Scalped wasn't a very long run. Was there a long Marvel run prior to that? Not as long as Thor.
No. I mean, I wrote Wolverine stuff for the like 6-7 years, but it was across a lot of different books. I guess the same way my Thor run was.
That's how it is now.
Right. I mean, I did, you know, I was somehow able to do a lot of issues of Avengers over the course of one book, but I think that's the only time I've done that at any point in my career.
How long were you sort of doing it professionally when you sort of felt comfortable turning down a thing and saying, that's not for me right now?
I mean, that's hard. That's a pivotal moment in your career. You know, I can't remember the first thing. I definitely turned down Robin at one point at DC years ago, before I'd even really started doing much at Marvel, or maybe I was just starting to do stuff at Marvel, but wasn't exclusive yet. So maybe that was the first.
Why didn't you want to do that?
I just didn't, it didn't feel right. Like, I had no idea what the hell do I do with Robin? Like, mm-hmm. I didn't have a story. I didn't have an in. I didn't have a connection at the time. Maybe I could have sat down and figured it out, but I just didn't. It wasn't clicking for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, when I talk to young creators, you know, you sort of see it. A creator comes in and gets hot, and suddenly they're getting everything in the world offered to them. And they still feel like, man, if I say no to this, this is the only time it's ever going to be offered to me. Right. Like, I love this character. And if I don't do it now, it's never going to happen. And mm-hmm. you just at some point have to stop and realize, like, look, these characters have been here a long time. Like, the most important thing is you put yourself in situations where you can do good work. If you just keep doing good work, the phone will keep ringing, you know, and that character, that book's not going anywhere. Like, it'll still be there. You know, I mean, I think every writer I know in comics has had times where you just maybe writing too much stuff, you know, and that's never good. It's hard to do your best work when you just got too many pots on the stove.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever like a situation where you had a story you've had for a character and you sort of put it on hold because it, like, you wanted to wait until you know, were better at it or just a better time, or he's like, I'm going to hold on to this one for a while because I think I can do it better later?
Not exactly. I think that's always a dangerous attitude to take, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, like, you need to be doing your best. There's no holding the best stuff for later necessarily, because if you're not doing your best stuff now, that later might not come, right? Like, the mm-hmm. important thing is always to be doing your best work you can do in that moment. If this idea or story doesn't fit for what you're doing at the time, then you can't just force something in.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done that, you know, or just where, you know, I'm supposed to do this book and then it doesn't work out and I'm doing this other book. And so I save that story for something late, you know, like I did Wolverine Goes to Hell, which was originally a Hellblazer idea where, like, you know, John Constantine's soul gets sent to hell and a demon's running around in his body on Earth. And didn't, you know, I did a couple issues of Hellblazer and was maybe going to do more and then signed a Marvel exclusive. So I ended up, you know, kind of dusting that idea off and using it in Wolverine. So this, you know, and stories, I mean, in terms of creator owned stuff, there's stuff that's rumbled around in my head for, you know, for years and years before you kind of figure it out and find the, you know, the right co-creator and the right circumstance to bring it to life.
So for you, say that you have a creator owned idea in your head, something that pops in, you let it rumble around, you sort of, you know, how actively do you end up developing those, and sort of when do you get the sense, like, now is the time to sort of take this forward, and, like, where do you go from there?
Well, I think that's a big question. I think that's a hard question to answer. I think there's a lot that goes into that, you know? I mean, that's a question that's driven, their answer's driven in part by the creative part of things, mm-hmm. of, like, when is this story, when is it baked long enough? When is it fully formed enough to kind of put it together and bring it out into the world? When does it feel, you know, when's it, like, pressing on my brain? Mm-hmm. When is it, like, it's, you know, it like, now's the time to, you know, strike while the iron is hot. Like, this thing wants to be written now, so I need to run with it. But the other part of it with creator-owned stuff is you're talking about business decisions, too. It's not a purely, you know, a creative decision, and that each creator owned book you do is like starting a new small business, you know? So a big part of that is, where are you doing it? Who are you doing it with? And those aren't simple questions to answer. Like, it's, for me, it's never been about, like, well, I have this idea that I want to do and just find anybody who I can do it with, you know, or it's a much more selective process, and that you are going into business together. So it's like, who's the right person, the right fit to do this book with? And then maybe they're busy. Maybe they're tied up for a year and a half. So are you going to wait? Are you going to start over and find somebody else? Once you do start working on it with creator-owned stuff, like where are you doing it at? If you're doing it in Image, are you getting advances so you can get these people paid as they're working on it? Like how long is it going to take schedule-wise? Like all that kind of stuff kind of goes into it. That's very different if you're just hopping on, you know, to write some issues of Fantastic Four at Marvel, right? Where there's a whole office building full of people to figure out all that other shit that you don't have to worry about. You just got to turn your scripts in on time. So yeah, I mean, it depends. It kind of,
we'll just say that, like, you know,
that's why it takes years sometimes to like bring the creator-owned book to life. Sorry.
No, so you're walking around, you see something, it causes something to sort of get an idea in your head. Do you write that? Like, are you the kind of person who writes that down immediately and then sort of keep coming back to it? Like, there's got to be a certain point. Like, when do you sort of go from the subconscious to consciously trying to sort of produce the story? Or is right. there a process you have for that?
Yeah. I mean, I guess to me, like, over the course of the last, you know, 15 years at this point, at some point, because I'm writing so many, I'm already actively writing so many things, I think a lot of my brain is focused on that. Mm-hmm. You know, like you need a lot of brain space for all that stuff to kind of percolate and simmer. And so I find there's not always much of like, hey, this idea for a brand new thing just suddenly popped out of the blue. Right. It's like it doesn't have space to make it into the party because there's all this other stuff that's already taken up the, you know,
the brain. Absolutely understand that.
So sometimes it's a matter of me saying, you know what? I should figure out a new creator-owned idea. So either start from scratch or, you know, pull out something from the past that's been, you know, popped up years ago, or I'd started to formulate years ago and then dust it off. So I feel like a lot of the creator owned stuff kind of, you know, you build it out of necessity. Like, okay, like if I want to do a new creator owned book, what should that be? Well, I'd like to do one in this genre. So what are the pieces I want to use to kind of assemble that? So yeah, certainly things do pop out of the blue. Ideas pop out of the blue. And I, you know, I always will write it down somewhere. I mean, I've never been one of those guys who's organized enough to like have one notebook I carry around with me at all times. So I've got stuff written down in different notebooks and in my phone and in files on my computer. So there's stuff jotted down everywhere, whether it's, you know, story ideas, character names, lines of dialogue, titles, all that kind of stuff that I'll wind up, you know, pulling off and using years down the line.
Do you remember that all exists? Or I would have a really hard time. Like, I'll write it down and then walk away. I'll never think about it again.
I mean, sometimes I'll read over stuff and be like, oh, I don't remember that. But no, I mean, I think I've always kind of had a mind for that. I feel like I'm an organized person. I'm just not like if you'd go into my room as a kid or now, like there's a lot of shit in there. Right. But I kind of know where everything's at, you know, like I'd always, when I was a kid playing with my toys, I'd always know where I left He-Man and Skeletor. Mm-hmm. Right. Like
I understand exactly what you're saying. 100%.
My brothers used to, I had a shitload of G.I. Joes. Like G.I. Joe is probably my favorite. And they'd like dump, they would take all my G.I. Joes and like take one out and then dump them on the floor. And I'd see how long it took me to look through them and be like, oh yeah, you know, Stalker's missing or whoever. So I feel like I've been able to kind of remember the relevant things from random thoughts I've jotted down over the years of like, oh yeah, what about that one thing that I had that one time? I should dig that out. The worst part is when you know that there's a thing somewhere and then you can't fucking find it. That's the worst. Or feel like I know, you know, sometimes if I'm lying in bed, there's always that kind of you know, just as you're starting to drift off to sleep and your mind kind of just wandering around and shit, like this scene that I've been working on all day that I couldn't figure out. Now it's suddenly the lines of dialogue are flowing, and I'll, you know, if I know if I don't write them down, I'll lose them, or just a beat or something. And when I feel like I know that, didn't I write that down like 2 weeks ago? Where the fuck did I put it? You know, like it's not in my phone notes. It's not, is it on this scratch pad or that scratch pad? So, and I'm pretty much always right. Like I did write it down somewhere, and then usually eventually I'll find it, because there's only so many places I could have put it.
Do you tend to be, I mean, do you tend to create and sort of work on stuff because you have a reason to, or you have a deadline, or you have a thing to move forward? Like you said, you know, if it's a creator own time, there's a time for it. There's a need to do it, rather than sort of just having a lot of stuff to draw on. I say that from the perspective is that I always do better like with a deadline. You have to create a thing, so you have to write it down and start from there. Is sort of how it works for me. But
I mean, you know, it's my schedule has kind of changed, especially over the last year as I, you know, my Marvel exclusive ended and I stopped doing ongoing books. So this last year has been a huge change in that I kind of worked a little less. Like I enjoyed sort of taking a break a little bit. It felt, especially after doing so many ongoing books over the course of the last few years, I was just a little worn out by that. I hadn't traveled in years. So I'm like, I'm going to write a little bit less and just, you know, go to more shows. So, well, you know, went to more European shows and just enjoyed recharging my batteries a little bit that way. And then the other part is that once I was not exclusive for the first time in years, suddenly I could answer kind of any call or email that came my way, where it's like, sure, I'll do, you know, a couple issues of that or, this story. So suddenly I'm writing a lot of different smaller projects kind of, you know, all over the map. So it definitely has changed just the way I work, I guess, the way my schedule is. Also, like, suddenly, you know, I've gone to, like, not being exclusive means I got to write a lot of pitches too, which I, when I was just writing ongoing books for Marvel, I didn't really have to do, right? It'd be like, hey, do you want to write this or that? And I'd be like, sure. And then figure it out. Now I'm having to like pitch for things. And so all that's kind of just changed my week to week workload, I guess. Was that the question? What was your
question? Sort of, but I mean, it's interesting is that, I mean, so based on that change, where like previously, you know, you had to do this book, it was due this week. Is this one, you know, the week you had a pretty regular sort of flow of work, and you've had to change that completely around. Was that, I mean, like you said, it's recharging and refreshing or whatever, but that sounds really difficult to sort of switch gears and slow down.
Right. It's definitely been a change, you know. It was like a change I was excited for and wanted, but it's... you know, it's been a big, it's been a lot of adjustments just in kind of my personal life and work life that I've had to roll with through all that. So some of them I expected and some of them were surprising. But ultimately I think it's all been good to just kind of excite me about doing a lot of new stuff, you know, like almost everything I'm working on at the moment is something new. Mm-hmm. Right? Like character I've never written before, company I've never worked for before, new creator owned stuff. Like it's just a lot of new. So I think, you know, like I'm saying, there's challenges and even just working with a company for the first time, there's figuring out the contract stuff, you know, from scratch. So it's just a lot more layers of things to navigate that I'd been, you know, again, it's like a regular freelance stuff. I'd just been spoiled and I didn't have to deal with that for so long when you're exclusive. But I mean, the work stuff, it's still, I mean, at this point now, it's still just kind of like it's always been for me, where every week I'm sitting down to ideally to start a new script. You know, sometimes ones might take a little bit longer, but usually I'm doing a script a week of this or that and jumping around from one project, you know, to another. And some of that, you know, will continue to change as I go forward next year, as I'm, you know, looking at kind of doing a couple of longer runs on things.
So previously your exclusive, you've got ongoing books going. Like, how did you like structure your work life? Like, did you work from these times during the day? Was there always something going on?
No, I mean, I can't say I'm like a rigidly structured guy in that way. You know, I mean, I think having young kids helped with that, and that in the early days, like, was stay at home dad and help my kid get up in the morning and get off to school and know he's coming home at a certain time of day. And, you know, it means you're not going to keep like heroin addict hours, right? Like some other creators I know don't have kids, where you call at any of the time of the day or night. You don't know if they're going to be just waking up or just going to sleep or whatever. Like I get it. Like it's refreshing sometimes to be able to just fall down a work hole. I mean, I'll do that sometimes. Now my son's 18, so it's not like a, you know, requiring my constant care and supervision. So I can fall down a work hole, you know, and if he's not here, I don't speak to anybody over the course of a whole day. I'm just lost in work. So it's good to be able to do that sometimes. But so I think my schedule's kind of always been all over the map. I'm definitely not a morning person. I hate waking up early. I think my brain functions a lot better at night than it does early in the morning. But I mean, I don't. It depends. Like, I'm just every day I'm trying to get up and do some kind of work. But that doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to be sitting down hammering out, you know, 10 pages of dialogue. It kind of each day I'm kind of doing different things, and some. Maybe one day I can sit down and write almost a whole script in that day. Other times, you know, it'll take me days to figure out one scene. But you just kind of got to always be working in some regard. And there's, you know, there's lettering drafts and corrections and interviews and research for all the right podcasts. So many podcasts. You know, just all that kind of stuff that's still part of the job. So I've never been like, you know, well, like 10 to 3 are my writing hours, mm-hmm. and I just shut everything else off. I don't really function that way. Some of it is you got to kind of do when I sit down to actually write this scene, write this script, write this dialogue, I've kind of done most of the other work, like the heavy lifting to sort of get to that point. That's like the easy part or the fun part. It's like all the kind of work you got to do to get to that point of figuring out the beats of the story and everything. And sometimes that might mean I go for a walk, you know, or doing things that don't look like that they are me being productive at my job, but actually are, because it's all the shit that's rumbling around in my head.
Do you tend to work on stories in that same way? Like, you start with, you know, like, you have a premise, and then you've got to sort of beat it out and figure out what the acts are and whatever. Like, does that generally work the same for you?
I think so. I mean, some of it, I mean, it depends on kind of what, I guess, what my relationship, what my connection is with that character. Do I know who this character is, or who is this character to me? What is important to me to have in this story to show.
And that's where it starts for you most of the time, with the work for hire stuff, is the character.
I think so. I mean, if it's someone if it's a character I've never written before that I don't quite understand. I mean, I think with, you know, like when I got the Thor job, wasn't a huge Thor fan before that moment. I hadn't read a ton of Thor, read the Walt Simonson stuff, most of it, like when it was coming out when I was a kid. And then I'd really liked Matt Fraction's Ages of Thunder one-shots that he did kind of, you know, before he took over the book. Those really struck a chord with me. So I think I kind of had a germ of an idea of just how do I see this character and what clicks for me about this character. And then had to do the work to kind of read a bunch of Thor comics and figure out the pieces of and figure out what my story was. So I sometimes I come into it, you know, like there's some characters I'm writing now that I, well, like when I did Conan, you know, like I grew up reading all those Conan stories, loved them. Like I'd kind of definitely had a clear picture in my mind of this is who this character is. And these are the parts of it I think are important. And this is what needs to be in the story. And it's what it's ultimately about. So some of it, you kind of come into it with that. Other times you just got to build that and put it together. But yeah, I think it's, to me, it always starts. I think I'm more a character guy than necessarily like, well, here's my, you know, big idea. I think it starts with like, who is this person? What is my connection to them? You know, like, do I, if I don't have one, I need to figure it out. And just like, what is this story really about? You know, I think the stories I've done that I think have come together in the most fulfilling way are ones where I went into it like with a real clarity of vision of this is what this is, right? Not just this is who he fights in issue 3 and this is how it goes, and but just like what is this really about, you know? And once you know that, then it all starts to fit together, you know, like what the tone of it is, what the aesthetic, like what the everything. When just when you have that clarity of vision of like this is what I ultimately at the kernel of it, at the, you know, the core of it, this is what this story is. And that may even be in a way that, you know, you don't communicate directly, that people maybe get that, maybe don't, from the story that you write. But I still think for me as the creator, that helps everything, like that clarity guides everything going forward.
Do you have that conversation like just on your own in your head, or is that something that, you know, like you talk with editors about, or if you're, I mean, if it's creator, I'm assuming you're having that conversation with the artist you're working with. But is, yeah, it largely, I mean, I think sort of in your own mind where you're going with that, your guiding star?
Yeah, I think it all starts as a conversation I'm having in my own head, because I'm not, like, I know a lot of other writers who are big on talking stuff out with you know, their friends, with other creators, and I've never really done that. I mean, I think I'm more, that's just not the way my process has worked. You know, I mean, I've enjoyed times I've gone to Marvel retreats and that sort of thing where you do figure stories out in a room, but that's not really the way I do my stuff. It's a very like isolated, insular process. And I'm, cause it's all, it's, you know, it's just me trying to figure out the best version of the story that I want to read. That's the only way I know how to do it. So usually by the time I'm walking into having a conversation about this book or this story with an editor or the artist or whoever, I need to already have that clarity in my head, right? Of like, this is, you know, I know kind of what pieces went into this. This is what influenced this. This is what it looks like. You know, I want to always already have an idea of that before I'm talking to anybody about it.
What would you say is still sort of the most challenging part of sort of putting together a story? And second part of that is like, how is that different than when you, you know, the first couple of years you were working? Like, is it sort of the same stuff? Is it different things that sort of you didn't know about earlier? Or?
I mean, I think the challenge is just to keep doing it, right? You know, like to keep like, well, that was great. Yesterday was great. That one turned out great. Now today we're starting from scratch all over again, you know? Maybe with something where what you did in the past has absolutely no bearing on whatever you're doing now. So I think just continuing to do it, like to stay invested and refreshed and excited and not get, you know, burnt out, not get caught up in just the business part of things. That I mean, I think rightly or wrongly for me, I think creative kind of always guides a lot of my decisions. So I think just still feeling invested and capable of that part of just doing it again and again and again. And you know, part of me looks at some creators who you create the one big thing and then you just kind of do that thing forever, right? And I feel like, man, that's got to be kind of nice because you don't really have to come up with any new things. But part of me also feels like, well, I don't think I'd want to do that, you know? Like, I think the way I take in media and stories, like, I'm always kind of looking for new and different stuff. I don't just read, you know, the same genre, the same sort of stuff over and over and over again. If you look at my comic book pull list, it's like stuff's all over the map, right? Like, not necessarily things that I don't write books like this one or that one, but I enjoy reading them. So I think I'm always going to be like that, where I enjoy the challenge of doing new and different things, but it does get, you know, more challenging. Just like, if, you know, with a band, sometimes you, mm-hmm. like, man, you're on your fourth album and you run out of good songs, right? Like, you put all your passion and the everything that was important to you from your formative years, you put into those first three albums, and now it's like, well, what do I have to say now? So I think continuing to figure that out, is the hardest part.
As you're sort of getting into, you know, nearing the end of sort of the second decade of making comics professionally, the idea of having something new to say that keeps you excited, not to mention readers, is probably pretty tricky. And as you're talking about it, is that I can sort of look at your work history and there's a lot of different types of comics in there. And I don't think that I think of, oh, this is a Jason Aaron comic, but I think when I read them, I can see you in it. And I think that's a good way to be, because some people like, oh, they do this type of comic, but you really are kind of all over the map. Although some of it is some very dark shit.
Right. Well, thanks. I don't think I ever, again, I don't think that was ever a conscious decision for me. Like, I never set and mapped out like, okay, I'm going to do some dark stuff for a while, then I'm going to do something zany and ridiculous. And then, you know, like, there was never a plan. I think that's just kind of the way I'm wired, and that's what I'm attracted to. And I just got all that different kind of stuff in me that I want to do. So, I mean, I like exactly how you described that. And I'm kind of proud of that, of feeling like I have done a lot of different stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes if I'd see someone complain about, well, you know, he always does this or always does that, I'm like, clearly you haven't read that much of my work. Like, maybe these two things are like that, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of them that haven't been. So I think that hopefully, you know, helps me out in the long run, and then I continue to be able to do new and different stuff. You know, I think something like I'm doing Once Upon a Time at the End of the World right now at Boom, which to me feels like completely different than really anything I've done before in a lot of different ways. It's, you know, even within that one book, it's kind of three very different stories, and each arc is a different period in the lives of these characters and drawn by different art teams. So that's been a completely new challenge, which has been really exciting. So I want to keep doing that. And again, you know, switching and getting to write DC stuff for the first time. So it's like a little bit like starting over. Writing Superman for the first time, I felt like I was a kid, you know, sitting down to write my first comic. Like, I was nervous. So I think those things are good, you know, like I do feel like just this year I've kind of entered a different stage of my career where kind of my goals are different. What I'm interested in is different. The stuff I'm doing feels different. And that's great. And at some point I'm sure that will turn again, and there'll be, you know, a third stage that I'll enter. But for now, it feels like I'm kind of just getting started on this one, and there's still a lot of new stuff to get to.
So when you were younger and sort of newer to the industry, did you have an idea about how you wanted your career to be? And did it end up like that, or is something different? Accepting it's not over. That's not right. The point.
No, I don't think I had any idea other than just, I want to do that. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, if you'd asked me when I was a kid, I would have told you I wanted to write for DC, mm-hmm. you know, because I was reading Batman and Blue Devil. I'd be like, yeah, give me a Blue Devil book and I'll be happy. Let me write Teen Titans. So I don't, even when I was breaking in, you know, like I said, I think I figured out quickly, like the relationships and the editors are the important part of that. Mm-hmm. So, beyond that, no, I can't say I've ever really had a plan. I feel like, to me, like I said before, it's been important that I try to keep the creative part of it at the foremost and do, you know, I didn't decide to do Thor because, well, it was a big book or it seemed like the right move career wise. It was because Thor sparked in my brain and I wanted to tell a story with that character. And I feel like that needs to be the guiding principle. Sometimes I hear creators talk about, well, I've been working on this book for Marvel for a while and now I need to move on to something that's, you know, like an elevated from that. And I don't, I get it. I get you want to feel like you're, you know, you're just worried about your place and the company and you want to feel like you're building and you're getting bigger stuff. But I think it's, to me, it's always most important of just do your best shit. Like, put yourself in the position to do your best work and make your decisions based on that. And that's kind of the only directive I've had. I've never looked at it as like, how do I build, you know? And maybe the times I should think more of those things, but I'm just not wired that way. I still feel like if you just do good shit, you know, like that's the important part. I was in college and I went to, I've talked about this before because it's such a important moment for me, but I went to a writer's conference in Birmingham Southern University. And Ray Bradbury was there. I got to meet Ray Bradbury and hear him talk, which was amazing. But I remember going into it, and they had different panels and stuff. And one of them, people were talking about how do you get an agent. And I was kind of dismayed of like, it seemed like a room full of people. And so many of them were convinced they had written the next great American novel, right? Like, I've got it. It's done. It's right here. I just need to know, how do I get an agent? How do I get a book deal? How do I sell it? And to me, I felt like looking around that room, like chances are, probably none of you have written the great American novel, right? Mm-hmm. Like, odds are. And I feel like, I know I am certainly not capable of doing that. I just want to know, how do I get better at that part of it? And I thought, if I just get good enough, you can figure out the other shit, right? People figure out how to break into an industry all the time in all different ways. There's so every writer I know in comics has a different story of how they broke into comics. But all of them did the work to just get good enough to when that opportunity does come along, or when you make it come along, that you are ready to step up to the bat and show this person something worth their time and attention. And so I just focused on that for a long time, which mostly means just writing a lot of really bad stuff that you hope no one ever reads. And just being obsessed with the writing part of it and not the business machination part of it. And I think that's continued to be, rightly or wrongly, continued to be my guiding principle of, I just want to go where I can do good work that I feel good about, that I have that sort of clarity about.
I think I can, I'm just saying it that way, I think I can see that. And I think it works really well in terms of, I know what to sort of expect when I see your name on a book, meaning that, you know, you're going to write a good story. You're going to put your thing into it. And I don't follow sales charts. I don't know what's popular. You know, I know that it's a bigger deal to be on Avengers than it is to be on a Daredevil miniseries, but I think you're lucky to a certain extent. I mean, you have the talent and everything, but there, you know, there's certain factors that allow you to do that, and you've been able to do that for a long time. It's kind of a platonic ideal of how you'd want to be a creator in a way.
Right. I mean, I think luck is involved in some sense, but I think you also, you know, you make your own luck, right?
I don't even mean how
you prepare for that moment when it comes along.
Let's say opportunity. The opportunity was there, and you sort of take it. The forces you can't control, I guess, and it's sort of worked out that way. And you were there to sort of do the right thing and follow up with it and really keep story forefront. And I think that's definitely the strength, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think the things you can control are exceedingly important. Mm-hmm. That's the creative part of it. What am I putting into this work? And the personal part of it, the relationship part of it, how you treat people in real life, mm-hmm. how you work with editors, how you work with other creators, things you say in interviews, things you say, you know, the way you act at convention, all the real, tangible, real life part of things are the things that are most important. You know, can some people succeed despite, you know, being bad at one or the other? Maybe sometimes, but I still feel like if you put those things first and foremost, you can navigate the other part. And some people are also just way better at the business part of it. That to me feels like work. Writing comics never feels like work.
Really?
No, I mean, literally, I'm like the cliche of like, well, I'd be doing this for free even if I wasn't getting paid for it. Cause I did. Like I've been writing stuff my entire life, you know, like I kind of need to do it. Like mm-hmm. it makes me happy.
I think you're very lucky to have that in a way. That's sort of that being the driving force of things and keeping you going. I think, that's always been a challenge for me to a certain extent. So you have that sort of thing to keep you going. That's luck in a way.
Yeah. Or just, you know, fucked up wiring in my brain. I don't know. Like I've certainly never been one of the writers who, or it's like a labor, right? Where it's like mm-hmm. where I'm pushing a boulder up a hill, and when that's it's amazing. Done, I'm like, oh my God, I hope I don't have to do that again anytime soon. Like I enjoy it, you know. Mm-hmm. When I fucked up my back a few years ago and was kind of high on pain meds and couldn't write anything for a month, and mm-hmm. I just felt broken, you know, like mm-hmm. that. More so than even just my back not working. Like that was somehow worse and more painful, just not being able to write. It's like there was just a fundamental piece of me that was not functioning properly, just because that's always been a thing that keeps me, you know, gives me joy. It keeps me happy. And despite whatever else has been going on around me, right, which mm-hmm. has been definitely put to the test over the course of the last few years, that keeps me centered and focused. And it's been a constant. I mean, literally through my almost most of my conscious life, mm-hmm. right? Like that creative pursuit has been a guiding principle. And I know not every creator is wired the same, but to me, that's been a you know, an important part of my entire career is being guided by that.
So as we sort of start to get to the end of our time, I'm interested because I was looking at the sort of dates.
Are we dying? Like what?
No. I don't know why I phrased it that way. It didn't like everything I thought of.
Is there a surprise ending?
No, there isn't.
Did the test results come back?
I have to think. Well, that's just what I have to tell you. No. So I was sort of looking at the dates of everything, and then your, it's an apocryphal story. You won the sort of Marvel talent contest with the Wolverine story, and then I sort of didn't realize how much time had passed between then and sort of getting the other side out and going. And so if you're talking about sort of improving the craft and improving your writing, over that time, how were you getting better, and how did you know you were getting better? Because were you getting feedback from people? Like, it's one thing you can sort of develop your craft on your own, but if you're a young creator, you're not necessarily being published. How can you know what's working? How do you know you're getting better?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, yeah, there were 5 years between when my talent search contest story came out and when The Other Side, number one, came out. So a lot of it in that time was, you know, the talent search thing had gotten my foot in the door for the first time. So kind of, you know, editors would reply to my emails. So there was a lot of me writing pitches for different things. This was kind of the period before I sort of had the realization that I should focus on specific editors and specific relationships. And so I was doing that thing everybody does where you just, oh, you're looking for a story for this character? Okay, here you go. So I was chasing any lead in any possible job I could, which none of it ever yielded anything. Like, got no single job from any of that. But as part of that, the one job I did get was, you know, Marvel announced Bill Gemmis had the idea to do a relaunch of Epic Comics. Despite all his, you know, I never met Bill Gemmis, despite all the stories about how wild and crazy he was. He did in a roundabout way help give me my entire career, and that he was responsible for that Marvel Talent Search contest. And then he decided to do this Image relaunch where they would take pitches for a reimagined version of Marvel characters. So as part of that, you had to turn in the first issue script. So I wrote a script for a relaunch of the NOM, which was what would ultimately become The Other Side. And so part of it, that was the first, you know, full 22-page comic script I'd ever written. You know, before that, I had just written that 10-page Wolverine story. So first one I'd ever written, definitely the hardest I have ever worked on any one script. You know, you talk about, like I said, having clarity of vision for a project. I had profound clarity of vision for that one because I had spent so much time and energy and brain power figuring that out. But, you know, part of it is inspired by my cousin who is a Vietnam vet and novelist, Gus Hasford. So I'd spent kind of years sort of researching his life. And so there was a lot of work I was already doing before I had the idea to do this story. And then I did tremendous work researching stuff. I mean, by the time the book, you know, got approved at Vertigo, I had this huge like cache of reference images and not just stuff related to the Vietnam War, but, you know, there were a lot of different literary references and involved in the story. So I had it's not like I'd written like an Alan Moore level script necessarily in terms of panel descriptions, but just all the stuff that went with it.
But it was there in the background.
Right. There were a lot of links and like, you know, reference files attached. So some of it, what I was doing during that period was putting a ridiculous amount of energy into that one thing, which ultimately paid off. I mean, it took a while, and that I got a rejection letter back from Epic. Somebody had written a note on it. It was just like a, you know, form letter, but somebody had written a note telling me that I was on the maybe pile for a while, which was a nice when you're in that period where you're looking kind of for any sort of positive sign, that was a big one. So I should look up and see who wrote that. So then I kind of pitched The Other Side around here and there and talked to a lot of different people and was trying to figure out how to make it work. And one of the people I sent it to was Will Dennis at Vertigo. And, you know, he turned me down a couple of times, but then he read the script that I had spent so many hours working on, and the book got green lit. So some of it just that kind of fanatical devotion to telling this one story, which I think is an important part of breaking in, of just, again, that clarity of vision. I see what this is. I feel like this is an interesting story. If I saw this on the shelf, I would read it. I would pick it up and pay money to read it. And I feel like it's different than what's out there, right? It's not just another version of 20 other books, but there's not a book like this. I think all those things were important pieces to me kind of breaking in for the second time. You know, like that Marvel Talent Search contest was super big and super important. And I maybe wouldn't be writing comics without it, right. But it didn't directly lead to anything else. You know, I've never gotten a gig just based off that. The other side, a Vertigo opened the door for me to do Scout, and those two books together were more responsible for getting me the Marvel work I did after that than the Marvel Talent Search Contest was. So, that, you know, I kind of broke in two times.
Will so the told other me side that story, still, and he left out the part that he turned you down several times. It was just, I picked this off a slush pile, and I ran to Karen Berger, and I said, "You have to do this." He's a real hero of that story.
Yes. Well, he was not just that he turned me down, but he was polite to respond to my emails out of the blue in the first place. Right. And just said, basically saying like, I'm not looking for war books. Nobody reads war books, even if they're written by Garth Ennis and nobody's ever heard of you. So like, sure, I'll take a look at it, but I can't use it. And so he kind of told me that two times before even really looking at it, like, yeah, don't get your hopes up. Kind of thing. But yeah, then he read it and took it to Karen and that's opened the door for everything I've done since. But
what was that day like for you? You get that call and you're like, we're going to, you know, I assume it wasn't like you're greenlit, but you know, that right. sort of first yeah, no. positive.
I can't remember specifically that. For some reason, I remember vividly remember the day Will called me to tell me Scalped was screenlit, which would have been a few months later. I'd been working on the other side for a bit by that point. I'd wrecked my car that week, so I was standing at the bus stop after work, coming from my job at a warehouse job. So I remember that. I can't remember exactly where I was when it was probably an email when he told me the other side was greenlit. But yeah, you know, life-changing days.
So that email comes in, you look at it, you're looking at we'll say your computer, this is before smartphones, you know, like, what do you, like, do you,
I'm old.
Do you yell out loud? You're a tiny bit older than me. Like, is there a shriek? Is there like a satisfied nod? Like, what do you do when that happens?
Yeah, I'm not a big shrieker.
I'm not shocked by that.
Probably a... Yeah, I mean, if you were standing there looking at me, maybe you couldn't tell a difference. Like, oh, did this guy just get a free $5 coupon for the yogurt store? Like, what? He seems mildly happy. I don't know. Or maybe I had a big, ridiculous... I think that's ridiculous... what I
was hoping. You'd picture, be like, no, man, I took my shirt off. I ran around the neighborhood. And that would be surprising. Right? You put those feelings in the stories, I suspect.
Yes. I feel like I am a happy, joyful person, but you maybe wouldn't know that from my facial expressions.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not sure. There would have been nobody, none of these moments, like when I won, you know, I got a call, I had a voicemail to call Mike Martz at Marvel, which is when I won the Marvel Talent Search Contest. Mm-hmm. And then whenever the other side got approved and when Scalp got approved, there was no one around to witness these moments. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the Scalped one, I was like standing at the bus stop on the phone when Will told me, and the bus pulled up and I just like waved him on. I'm like, I'm going to finish this call. So the bus driver probably just saw me as like, well, this fucking guy, like, why is he standing at the bus stop? He didn't want the bus.
I mean, that was the right move. It wasn't, I got to get on this bus, I'll talk to you later. So right. you made the right call.
Right. I'm going to enjoy this conversation free of the bus.
Free of bus noise. So this is, I ask people this a lot, and I find it interesting, is that at what point, you're a kid reading comics, you're interested in stories, you want to write, at what point is it that you sort of see a comic book for what it is and how it works as a sort of storytelling method, as opposed to just cool stories about a superhero? Like, when do you feel like you start to understand it as a, not even as an art form, but as a sort of a mechanism telling a story, how comics work?
Geez, I don't know. I think I'm still figuring that out. I'm not sure.
Which is fair. Like
I definitely remember I was really young when I just kind of figured out, oh, like people make this and I want to do that. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have the first fucking idea of well, how does that work? How do you do that? Where do you go? And what does that look like? And no clue. So I think the first time I ever saw a comic script would have been when I bought the, I've still got it, like the first hardcover edition of Watchmen. Mm-hmm. That had like Alan Moore's, probably just a script for the first issue. So
it's literally the first three pages, but it was 40 right. pages of the book.
Right. So in my mind, that's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. Right. And the first time, like in when I was in grade school, I went to a small school in a small town in the South. And so there was like me and one other dude who were the comic nerds and my friend John, and he loved to draw. So I was like, great. You know, so at some point I wrote him a script for some, what I'm sure would have been a really terrible comic. And I was trying to write it like that Alan Moore script. So it was super long, ridiculously detailed, because I thought, well, that's what you're supposed to do. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, you know, did the common rookie mistakes where there's like three different things happening in one panel. I'm mm-hmm. sure it was terrible.
You're a kid. It's okay.
Right. So I think it, in terms of like figuring out, I mean, I think to me, you know, I mean, I have always read comics, right? Like from the time I started reading as a kid off the spinner rack, I've never stopped. I never drifted away and came back. My brain has constantly been feeding on comic book storytelling. So I think mm-hmm. some of it is that, right? Like you just have to, You intake that enough, it just becomes something, should become instinctive about it, right? The most mm-hmm. important part is understand how to tell a story.
Yeah.
And I think that if you know that, you can translate that into different mediums, right? But you have to understand the storytelling part of it. So I think most of my formative years were spent figuring out that part of it, not necessarily how do I specifically tell comic book stories, how do I write a comic. I think I would learn that really while doing it. Yeah. You know, I would learn that from, you know, doing that Marvel Talent Search story, working with Will on, I mean, I still didn't know what I was doing when I sat down to write Scalp Number One, which would be, you know, the first issue of my first 60 issue plus ongoing series. I was still figuring things out then, working with R.M. Guerra on that book. So yeah, but I think but I had spent years and years learning, well, how do you write? How mm-hmm. do you tell an engaging story? And I think that all paid off ultimately, even as I figured out the comic part of it. Mm-hmm.
What do your scripts look like now compared to what they, have they been the same for a while? Is it an ongoing, they adding more, leaving more out?
I mean, maybe they're a little less wordy. I mean, I think like if I looked back at that other side script, I mean, I think it's more skew into the Alan Moore side of the fence, still probably like still pretty dense. So I think they're less dense. And I mean, they've probably looked exactly the same now for, mm-hmm. for a few years. I know, you know, I've enjoyed over the years kind of getting scripts from other writers. Mm-hmm. Cause again, like, you know, growing up, I never saw that. I didn't know what the hell they look like. And then you see, once you start reading scripts from different writers, you're like, oh, well, nobody knew what they were supposed to look like, cause everybody's doing it different. And I remember, you know, reading like one of Ed Brubaker's scripts and then showing him mine. And he scolded me cause like everything was numbered, you know, like, well, there's the pages numbered and the panels are numbered and every line of dialogue or caption is numbered. So there's just too many numbers, Ed said. So I do less numbers now, but some of it, I think probably initially in the early days, I felt like, well, I can't, you know, I gotta justify my pay, right? I can't just write a short little 3-word description for this.
They fight.
Right. Like I feel shameful doing that, but I, you know, you've gotten used to some of that because ultimately it's all a matter of, I mean, it changes depending on who I'm working with and what is my relationship with this person and what do they need from me, right? I mean, it's a weird job in that what I write is really only read mm-hmm. by a couple people and really only intended for one person. That's the person who's drawing it. So what do I need to give to them? And that, you know, that depends on what they need. So like with, when I'm working with Gera, who I've worked with, you know, a lot on a lot of different books, I don't, like in the early days of Scalped, I spent a lot of time choreographing this one fight scene, this shootout where I was watching a bunch of Peckinpah movies and trying to do the most Peckinpah of all comic book shootouts. And then Gera didn't draw any of it that way. So he doesn't need for me to do that for him. Like he's better left to just doing that on his own.
Did you have to learn that, or were you sort of told that? Or
no, I just I mean, I find nobody tells you anything. You have to learn everything as you go.
It's an introverted group.
That is, I mean, I've found that about every company I have worked at. There's no like, oh hey, welcome to comics. Here are the things you should know. Nobody ever gives you any of that. You figure it out as you go, and if you don't ask the question, you may never get the answer. So yeah, I learned by doing. But with Gera, with his, when I'm writing for him, I know he wants as much of the emotional content of the scene as I can put in there, right? Like not just what's happening, what are the people doing, but what are they thinking and feeling, and what are they thinking and feeling that's maybe different than what they're saying. So as much of the emotional stuff I can put in there, like that's,
I really like that.
That's what he wants.
That. That's cool.
And then other guys might be completely different, right? Like it's, so it just depends on kind of who you're working with. And again, cause my job is to give them what they need, mm-hmm. right? Like I start the relay with the baton and I do my part and then I hand it off to them. I'm just trying to set them up to succeed and to be able to do what they do. And then we, you know, we build this thing together.
Is there any kind of, I'm going to ask you one more thing and then we're going to get going. But is there any kind of craftsmanship that comes from comic book artists that you really look for and appreciate that sort of maybe you didn't know about when you were younger? Is there just a bit where, you know, like storytelling techniques or just things that as a professional you recognize, oh, this is an excellent comic book artist, you know, that maybe you wouldn't have known when you were younger?
I think appreciating someone who is really great at, I would just say casting, right? Like the look of the characters in the book, right? Mm-hmm. Not just you're great at drawing this action scene, you're great at drawing it, whatever, but look at the faces of people in the book. And does it look like, you know, a well-cast movie or TV show? But does everybody kind of look the same or mm-hmm. look like they, you know, they're all cousins? Like some people are just really, really good at just having this sort of wealth, being able to pull this wealth of faces and, you know, to build a world that feels like it's peopled with real people, right? Like these are real people. That's a skill that, you know, I don't understand where that comes from or how you do that, but I definitely appreciate the artists who are really, really good at it.
I could see as a guy who writes personalities like you do that would be a thing that you'd pick up on. It's a good answer. I like that. You didn't have to think about it. That's good stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I'd sit here at this desk and just make up shit every day. That's what I do.
This is all this stuff that
usually I'm not talking to anybody about it, but...
It's fine. No, I might not even really be here. You don't know.
Awkward silence, right?
There's all this stuff that I could ask you about with all the characters and the specifics, but this is always what happens. I like talking about the craft and the journey and all that stuff. So,
no, I like that too.
Maybe I'll have you come back around sometime. We can talk about how you feel about Superman.
Sure. Another 10 years. We'll do it again.
That's what I say. And then I'll look and I'm like, shit, it's been 10 years. out my back. All right. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Josh. It's always a pleasure.
And there you have another Talksplode in the books. I could have kept talking for a while. I think he might have been able to, too. I might be flattering myself. I don't know that. You can find Jason's books everywhere. There's a lot of Jason Aaron books out there. You want to read Scalp, you want to check out the Thor run, you want to check out Once Upon a Time at the End of the World. I forgot to ask him when I'm going to get to the end of Southern Bastards, but that's out there too, and it's still worth reading. You can find more at jasonaaron.info, and of course, I am from myfanboy.com, where you can find this show, and you can find 107 other Talksplode interviews that have been done mostly by me. There's one in Jason in there, but I didn't do it, so it's not me. Thanks to the patrons for supporting this show and the others. There's our weekly Pick of the Week podcast you can check out. I'm talking very fast. Thanks very much, everyone. I'll talk to you soon. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.